When you've worked a lifetime to build your savings and investments, you want to have that money working for you in your later years, working to preserve your lifestyle, to meet new goals, and to potentially leave a financial legacy. I'm Oscar Lynn Elder, Co-Chief Investment Officer for Truist Wealth, and this is I've Been Meaning to Do That, a podcast from Truist Wealth, a purpose-driven financial services company. We appreciate you listening. Today, we're talking about planning for longevity, in particular, the financial strategies that can keep the wealth you've accumulated productive, no matter how long you live. I have a wonderful guest for this discussion, and it's someone I know well, my colleague, Alex Knoll, who is the Managing Director of Brokerage Products here at Truist Wealth. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Well, thank you, Oscar Lynn, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, let's jump in. Let's start with why we're talking about longevity planning in the first place. Medical and technology advancements have driven longer lives. A study from the Pew Research Center projects that the number of Americans who are 100 years old or older will quadruple by 2054 to around 422,000. So, Alex, that's a lot of people living a long time. What are some of the challenges that longevity brings?
It's a fantastic question. The first thing that comes to mind ultimately is obviously the longer that we are living, the longer we have to plan. Historically, you've planned retirement, say 10, 15 years, 20 years. But in today's world, we're actually looking to plan 25, 30, 35 years, even longer because of that increased life expectancy. So when you consider the factors that go into that, not just the regular day-to-day living expenses that somebody needs to cover, but then also things like advances in medical technology to treat various things that can impact people as they age, the increased cost of those technologies as the new technologies come out, they're not cheaper than the ones from before. They're much more expensive. Then you have other things to consider from a cost and just basic inflation perspective that over that longer duration can cause some problems if not properly planned for.
And Alex, in addition to all the factors that you just talked about, which really focused on healthcare, medical planning, all of those elements, folks also have to think about the markets potentially. And so as folks age, weathering market volatility becomes a more critical element, I think, of their planning and their considerations around asset allocation.
That point you made about volatility, that is something that is so crucial to doing any type of plan. Volatility, to your point, it's not a bad thing. It's a thing. It can work for us. It can absolutely work against us. But understanding what volatility does on the positive side, as well as how it can impact us negatively, I think is so important, particularly as you're looking to plan for something over a longer duration than I think what has traditionally been done. It's a very critical point of what we're doing.
We've got a lot of ground to cover. So we'll dig into some of the specific strategies that are available to help our listeners on their journey when we come back. Alex, before we start talking about specific longevity-focused strategies, I want to call out that it's important for folks to understand their investment portfolios. And that can be a combination of retirement-focused portfolios like 401ks, IRAs, or even taxable portfolios. After retirement, these portfolios are often an essential source for income needs.
Absolutely. I think as you're accumulating assets over time at different phases of your life, you'll have different structures, different strategies, different focuses at each of those stages of your career and of your life. As you go ahead and you build your wealth, you use those different accounts, you have the ability to do different things. Everything that you're putting together ultimately is designed to work in conjunction with one another. Each account may have a very specific targeted use case for what they're looking to do for an individual or for an individual's family. But the way that all of those components work together, that ultimately goes to building that plan. And then inside of each of those accounts, as you consider things like allocation, Oscar Lynn, I know that is the focus of what you ultimately do, and you can touch on that a little bit more, but how you allocate each of those accounts, not just on their own, but in conjunction with one another, can really help an individual or a family build that longevity into those assets to make sure they're there when they're needed most and for as long as they're ultimately needed.
So, Alex, you bring up a great point about allocation. And so within the investing world, we talk a lot about asset allocation. And all that simply is how much of your assets ultimately are portioned over to equities or stocks. That part of the portfolio tends to be a growth driver. That tends to be why we invest in stocks, to create growth over the long term. Can also produce income, fixed income or bonds, which tend to be the stabilizing force within a portfolio. They provide stability and income ultimately. And then in a more simplistic allocation, also cash. And how much liquidity, current liquidity a client has is often very critical. And so as you walk through life, but especially as you're thinking about longevity planning, and perhaps you're approaching retirement or post-retirement, it's really important to understand your mix of assets, make sure it's appropriate to your plan and your situation. It aligns with your risk comfort zone. So you want to be able to sleep at night. You want to be able to have confidence that you're going to be able to achieve your goals. And that's why we talk about asset allocation, that overall view. Super important.
The different types of assets that you mentioned, the equities, the fixed income, the different things, they all behave differently in different environments. Of course, we know equities, they're designed to try to help grow our assets. And that is so important when you're planning for something over such a longer duration than what we've historically done. And at the same time, you want to make sure you have something that can offset some of that volatility. Remember, as we said before, volatility goes up, which is great, but volatility can work the other way as well. So helping diversify those equity holdings with the fixed income component can be a way to help narrow down, say, the potential range of outcomes. And then as you go through and you're doing that diversification, it's a great strategy to help, again, spread out those risks or to help offset certain risks, but it's not necessarily the perfect end-all be-all strategy. And as you and I have talked about before, there's other strategies out there where a client can ultimately leverage somebody else's balance sheet if they don't themselves want to absorb those risks. And as you combine all of those things together, thinking about the different accounts that we talked about, the different types of assets that are out there, and then different strategies where we can leverage other components, different solutions in the industry, I think that creates the kind of the holistic look at what you can do when you're trying to create a longevity plan.
All right, Alex, you mentioned a longevity plan. Let's turn to that specifically. At what age do you think longevity planning should enter into someone's conversation with their advisor?
I love this discussion because it's actively debated. The natural tendency is I'm going to start thinking about longevity when I'm older. But if you think about it, I really want to start considering longevity when I start investing, the very first time I start investing. Because as we're younger, we're early in our careers, we start investing in things like 401ks. We start opening up those taxable accounts that you mentioned. We're not investing for typically a 2, 3, 4 year period. We're investing for retirement.
We're investing for a lifetime.
Exactly. You're investing for that lifetime. So as you consider that, to answer that question, Oscar Lanitz, you start thinking about longevity really from day one, whether you realize it or not. You're trying to solve that longevity question. So then when you come to that time when you retire or you leave one career, go to the other where you need to self-fund some of those things, you're ready. And the earlier you start, the better opportunity you have to be ready when that time comes.
How does the discussion around longevity planning change as someone perhaps moves into their 40s or their 50s or their 60s? I would love for you to pick a decade that you feel is perhaps the most pivotal outside of starting the habit of saving and investing young, which we all believe in, right? That the power of compounded growth over time is just, it is one of the most powerful forces within finance. What decade do you think is the most pivotal in garnering people's attention around this topic?
And this is very much kind of the art versus the science, right? And the time of someone's life, our experience has shown, when someone enters their 40s is when they really start to consider it for the very first time. When people enter their 50s, they typically start to actually take the action. So if you think about what that statement means, I start thinking about it when I'm around 40, I might not on my own start truly acting on it until 10 years down the road when I'm 50. When you consider that, that's a decade that has gone by where we may not be doing that. But within that 20-year span between the ages of, say, 40 and 60, that is really the most active time where people start to think about longevity in the traditional sense as it pertains to retirement income, not outliving my assets, making sure I can live my life and truly not be a burden to the people I may leave behind.
And so what kind of conversations would you encourage folks to have with their advisors during their 40s and 50s specifically?
I think it really comes down to trying to understand what the individual or the individuals want to do. And you think when somebody is 40, they might start thinking a little bit about what they want to do in retirement. But between that age and when they actually retire, things will change. Their opinions will change. Their wants, desires will absolutely change. So I think having those discussions and digging in, just asking the open-ended questions to begin the discussion with the client, what might you want to do? Start to plant the seeds with the clients so they start to think about it on a somewhat regular basis when they're meeting with their advisor. Hopefully, you know, you're meeting with advisors at least one time per year, if not more. But just use it as an opportunity for the advisor to do a check-in with the client, for the client to do a check-in with themselves. Revisit it on a frequent basis. So as you're going through those years in the 40s and 50s, you can adjust your plan to accommodate for what your wants and desires might want to be in retirement.
The way I like to describe it is like we're trying to define the road. We may not at that point be able to like exactly what lane we're in, but we're kind of building the pathway, right? And it's coming into sharper focus because your earning years, if you're working in a corporate setting, for instance, you know, most folks are going to retire around 65, let's call it. And so at that point, you're looking at 20 to 10 years perhaps of still actively earning income from your career. And so coming into a little sharper focus. So as that happens, you're saying it's really important to clue into and to begin to really evaluate how longevity may impact your financial plan.
Yeah, it's an active conversation and an active dialogue over an extended period of time, mostly because circumstances change. The path that somebody might be on is going to be adjusted as you go over a period of time that is that long. So having that active dialogue, understanding that creating an income plan or creating a longevity plan, it's not a one-time exercise. It is an ongoing, living, breathing thing that will ultimately be the vehicle that allows somebody to live the life that they want to.
So ultimately, Alex, we are really encouraging folks, as you move into your 40s, into your 50s, really start to have these deeper conversations with your advisors around longevity planning specifically. And ideally, you've started building your wealth much earlier in your career, and you've got the great habits from that lifelong practice. Now the conversation really starts to focus on what happens after retirement? What happens if I live to 100? What might it look like? And how might I want my financial legacy to play out, if you will? And so look, when we come back, we're going to turn to discussing like the risk associated with navigating a long life and how our wealth planning strategies, so specific strategies, can minimize those risks. Alex, living for a long time is a good thing, but when it comes to financial planning, is it also fair to say that it's a risk?
Absolutely. The longer you live, the longer you have to plan for it, the longer you need to make sure your assets are around. And so the concept of longevity risk, Oscar Lynn, that's exactly what it is. It's the risk of outliving your assets, risk of outliving your income. So you're at a point where you may have certain needs that you can't fulfill because everything has been spent before.
And it's really at that point too, when we think about risk that are perhaps adjacent to the longevity risk, you begin to reach a point where you don't have quite as much time to endure, for instance, a market downturn. The potential that your capital, that your investment account experiences a sustained decline becomes more uncomfortable to folks because they're more reliant upon the portfolio for income and for cash flow needs. And so often what we see is that risk comfort zones really change over time.
I think to that point, ultimately, your timeline for correction is compressed.
That's right.
If I have a market movement, which is not in my favor, I have time to recover. When I'm getting into those retirement years, I no longer have the benefit of that time. I no longer have that gift of that time. I now have to make decisions in real time because I'm starting to live off of those assets. So some of the risks that have always been around my portfolio, have always been around my investments, now have a much larger place for me to consider as I'm going through and again, trying to live my life and leverage these assets to go ahead and live life. As we think of the risks that are out there, there are four main ones that we focus on as we're trying to consider longevity planning. Market volatility, which we've talked about a fair amount. We do break out longevity risk as one of the principal risks when we're building income portfolios. We also get the risk of taxation. And that's ultimately, you know, as we grow assets, we have gains. Unfortunately, those gains don't stay with us. They're not free. The government always wants to take their component of that. So we have to account for with what we make when we start to distribute those assets, what do we need to pay the government to be compliant with the tax code? And the fourth one, which really doesn't apply so much to this conversation, is then wanting to make sure we're efficiently transferring wealth to the next generation. But that's the fourth risk that we ultimately break things out for. There are subcategories in each of those four components, but those are the four main ones that we ultimately focus on.
And let's turn to the solution specifically that you believe can help folks sleep at night when they need to perhaps narrow the range of possible outcomes as they think about their total wealth picture and their longevity planning.
I think where that conversation starts is working with each individual to help them understand themselves, what risks they are comfortable absorbing and what risks they're not comfortable absorbing.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so an example, if we think about, say, things like market volatility, if I have a particular asset invested somewhere, I'm trying to understand how much of that volatility risk the client wants to take on. I might ask the question to the client, if I had $100,000 and that $100,000 fell to $90,000, would my client still be comfortable holding that position? Or would that begin to create some type of concern on the client's behalf? If the answer is the client would be comfortable there, I might back that down and say, well, what if it fell to $80,000? If they're still comfortable, I'm going to back it down until I get them to a number where they start to have that facial type of reaction where you can see the eyes squint a little bit, or they might turn their head or something like that, where I can start to sense, okay, so now I have an idea for how much risk somebody's willing to absorb and where I might need to be starting to set the point of considering options to help offset those risks. And it's at that point we want to make sure we're helping clients stay on task and on plan so that they can go ahead and meet their goals.
And to your point, if folks do reach a point where they feel like liquidating assets, especially taxable assets, are in the mix, and it's later in life, often there are gains that are built into those assets. And so there can almost be a multiple impact because of the realized gain. So Alex, let's turn for a moment to some of the specific solutions and strategies that our listeners could use if they have an interest in narrowing the range of possible outcomes within their financial plans.
Yeah, and ultimately, these would be solutions that come into play after diversification really isn't going to be the end-all be-all solution here. Two that immediately come to mind would be structured products and then annuity contracts offered by certain insurers.
Okay. So let's start first with structured products. What are structured products and how do they work?
Yeah, structured products are ultimately, you know, what the industry would call, right, a fixed income instrument. Think of that somewhat as like a bond, I think, to put it in more simple terms. Ultimately, what these do is they are structured investments set up to produce a certain type of return, but then also provide a certain level of downside protection. that protection is what can help narrow the range of returns. However, for that, there's a cost. And of course, that cost is you're limited on your upside compared to investing in something that would be very similar without that protection tied to it.
Can you give us an example of what you're talking about? Like, what does it look like in practice?
Absolutely. So a straightforward example would be, we have one of these structured products, and let's say we're going to tie it to what the industry will call an underlier. Think of it as it's tied to a specific investment. Many times something similar to an index, say like the S&P 500.
So S&P 500, an example would be tying the return potential to the return of the S&P 500.
Correct. And then from the protection perspective, is the note would be set up in such a way where if the S&P 500 had a return anywhere between 0% and say negative 10%, so it was down 10%, the client would realize none of that downside.
Okay.
The cost of that is if the S&P, say, was up in a year 30%, that particular structured product may only offer a maximum return over a set period of, say, 15%, maybe 10%, depending on how things are in the industry, could be something like 7%. So there's a trade-off on what that potential gain could be, but the benefit to the client is they know that downside is going to be protected.
And so I want to point out a couple of things to folks as they're listening. The terms of these types of structured products are continually evolving. So you're just giving an example. And it's really important that if they're in a conversation with an advisor, that they understand the specific terms around whatever their strategy they're considering in that moment. Is that fair?
Very fair. Very fair.
So you got to understand the terms of the product. In essence, what you're saying is that these strategy solutions allow for a certain level of upside and also provide some protection for a certain level of downside.
Correct. And that difference between the upside and that downside, that is that narrowed range compared to investing directly into what that particular structured product might be based on.
And so a structured product, what would you say generally this type of product works well for?
I think it's a variety of different uses. I think from a general perspective, they would be suited very well for somebody who wants to participate in a particular market, wants to invest in a certain area of the market. However, they don't have a full appetite to take on all the risk or all the volatility that can come with it. And of course, like we were talking about, the cost for that is your upside opportunity, that growth opportunity.
And what don't they work well for?
They don't work well for somebody who has a short-term time horizon. I should have said that also. These are meant to be long-term investments. So some of them can be set up for shorter time frames, much like a bond could be. You could have a two-year structured product time frame. You can also have them set up for, say, 7 or 8 years. The intent of the product is you want to make sure the assets you're investing will be invested in this product for the duration of whatever is set up at the time.
So you need to go into it with really a firm understanding that it's likely to best meet your needs if you hold it, in essence, until maturity for the full life of the vehicle.
Absolutely. You want to go into these with the understanding I'm holding this until maturity.
Okay. That's really important.
Very much.
And then tell us a little bit more around, I think it's really important in this space, if I remember correctly, that there are different entities that create these specific structured products.
Yes.
And so tell us about the role of those entities and what clients should know about the, let's call it the financial wherewithal of the issuer. So I just want to make sure folks, again, are armed with information as they're talking with their advisor to be able to really ask meaningful questions and understand how the product works and also what the risk may be and how to evaluate the opportunity.
Absolutely, Ed. The technical name for these entities would be the issuer. The way that we'll also phrase it, these are the creators of the products. The structured products, because they have a protection component to them, think of that as conceptually a piece of insurance. So to be able to make sure that value is there, every structured product is ultimately based on what is called the claims paying ability of that issue or that underlying product creator to be able to make a client whole based on the promise of how that structured product is ultimately set up. So said in another way, if we have a scenario where a structured product's protection component ultimately kicks in or becomes relevant, it would be that issuer who is making sure that client gets back every dollar that they are owed, as opposed to, of course, the underlying piece tied to it.
But ultimately, you're entering, as a client, you're entering into an agreement with that issuer. And so it's important that the issuer has the financial backing and stability to be able to make good on that agreement.
And the issuers that are prevalent in the marketplace, these are names that everybody knows. These are solid issuers. And then firms like a Truist, we have certain diligence that we do on the issuers to feel comfortable to offer such solutions to clients.
But it's certainly reasonable for a client to ask details about the issuer so that they have confidence that the issuer ultimately does have the strength to pay out.
Not only reasonable, we would highly encourage it.
Absolutely. Okay. And are there any other trade-offs that we would need to articulate for the folks listening?
Yeah, I think the other consideration we hadn't touched on in everybody's situation from this perspective is going to be different is taxation. There are different types of structured products that are ultimately out there. There are things called market-linked CDs. There are things out there called structured notes. Some of them have principal protection features. Others put principal ultimately at risk. I think as you're considering these things, consider your tax situation. Always talk to a licensed tax advisor as you're working through these things. But that would be something else that you'd want to make sure you consider.
So you want to understand the taxation elements. We're not offering taxation advice. We don't provide that direct advice. So if you enter into an agreement like this, it's really important that you talk with your tax advisor to understand the tax treatment. All right. Alex, you also noted annuities. So will you explain to our listeners at a high level, what is an annuity?
Yeah, at a high level, an annuity ultimately is a contract between an individual who would be the contract owner and an insurance company. What that contract ultimately states is my contract owner or my client is going to invest a certain amount of dollars with the insurance company, and they're going to get some type of benefit for that. Basic benefits would be things like being able to get a certain rate of return with a certain expectation of principal protection behind those. Something else might be a certain amount of protected income over a certain amount of time or either for somebody's lifetime. But ultimately, it's a contract between an individual and an insurance company where there is some type of promise tied to the benefits of an annuity.
So we could talk for hours about this, but what I want to distill for our listeners, when they're having especially the initial conversations around what may be possible from an annuity perspective, what are perhaps the three key areas that you would have them focus on?
Yeah, I think focusing on what an annuity does will answer all of these. Ultimately, there are two main benefits that we think about. One is ultimately being able to protect somebody's investment while they're able to earn some type of rate of return. Different flavors of this. Some are just ultimately set fixed rates in the case of, say, like a fixed annuity. You have other annuity solutions, say, like what are called index annuities that are similar in concept to what we discussed around structured products, where I may have a higher opportunity for return, but the trade-off for there is I may not have as much guaranteed interest that will be dedicated to the contract. The second element that I would mention would be protected income. And this is going to be protected income over either a set amount of time or it could be set up over somebody's lifetime.
And then is there a third element that you would have folks really focus on?
I think the third element is similar to what we talked about with the issuers or the product creators on the structured product side. It's understanding the underlying insurer and how the underlying insurer ultimately is set up from a financial standpoint, the backing that they have on these contracts, again, to make sure that when those guarantees or when that protection is ultimately needed, it's available.
How should our listeners think about the trade-offs associated with annuities broadly speaking.
Anytime you're going to have protection tied into an investment option, whether it's annuity, it's a structured product, or something else that can provide the same type of protection, there's typically going to be a trade-off either in the amount of opportunity from a growth perspective somebody has, or there could be a trade-off from a cost perspective. There may be a particular fee or something that is ultimately applied when you're using one of these things.
So the trade-off there is you're in essence buying a form of insurance, if you will, of protection, right? It could be principal protection. It could be income protection. And so that protection comes at a cost, and it's either opportunity and growth potential, or it's the fee associated.
Absolutely. And I think I'll reiterate, an annuity is a type of insurance. So much like you would pay premium for, say, homeowners insurance or life insurance, annuities do have costs. They have certain costs associated to provide those guarantees to you.
So Alex, can you give us a picture of what type of client experience does an annuity work well for?
Yeah, I think from a high level perspective, it's a client who's starting to see their retirement years truly come into focus. They're really getting serious about it, and they really want to begin planning for it.
Absolutely. And so it sounds like from what you've described, that part of that coming into focus and creating confidence in the financial plan and the longevity plan is the ability, especially from a principal protection perspective, for a client to take some assets, part of their overall wealth, if you will, think of it as a slice of their assets, and decrease the level of uncertainty around the return profile for those assets.
Absolutely. Any solution that, like an annuity or a structured product, it is meant to be a complement to that core. And that complement can be used to offset some of those risks that client doesn't want to absorb for themselves.
And then on the income side, if, again, that retirement picture is coming into sharper focus, on the income side, perhaps for folks who want more predictability around their income stream or their potential income stream, this is a solution that can decrease the level of uncertainty around a portion of their income stream in the future.
Absolutely. And then what it can also do, because more of the income is known, it allows the clients to invest their other assets in a way that sets them up for better long-term growth, or potentially sets them up for better long-term growth. So it gives the client more flexibility to do more with the other assets.
And I think the flip side, are there situations where you believe that annuities don't work well, that they don't really solve the problem or the challenge?
Yeah, and I think we deal with many of these on a regular basis, where clients have scale of assets where they really don't need this type of insurance. They don't need this protection. They may be willing to tolerate certain risks tied to market volatility. Again, we know it works for us. It can definitely work against us. Clients may be tolerant of it. They may have other things in place, say like their company offers them a pension. That is how my parents lived through retirement, was actually a pension. Companies don't offer those as much as they used to, but you have situations where you really don't need an annuity. It comes down to what risks are the clients comfortable taking on, which ones do they not want to take on, and then the ones that they want to look for a solution, are they willing to ultimately pay that cost, whether it's an actual dollar like a fee cost, or whether it's giving up potential return opportunity.
So Alex, we should remember that as we think about our longevity plans, that every decision has a trade-off. It's really basic economics. Every decision has a trade-off. It really speaks to the importance of having a trusted advisor on the journey with us and with you. It's been such a helpful discussion, and we'll wrap up everything here in just a moment. Alex, as we wrap up here, one question for you, and we have a tradition on I've Been Meaning to Do That, that we ask each guest, what's the one thing that they've been meaning to do that they haven't done yet, and that they're willing to commit to publicly on this episode to doing in the near future? What comes to mind for you?
That's such a good question. It's dangerous too, because I'm putting this out there. Yeah, I've always heard the old adage that doctors are their worst patients. And a lot of times financial advisors are also their worst clients. I'm a financial planner, a certified financial planner. And you know, one of the things I've been thinking about lately is reviewing certain coverages I have from an insurance perspective. I have two teenage kids. One's a freshman in college, and they've both started driving, and one is driving in a different state. So reviewing my personal insurance coverages to make sure, one, I have the most cost-effective insurance out there, as you have teenage drivers. For those of you who do, you know, your premiums go up a little bit, but then also want to make sure I have adequate coverage. I have the right coverage for the needs that I have.
That's a fantastic. I've been meaning to do that. I will come back to you in a few weeks and see where you are on that particular to-do item. And let me ask, if a listener really wants to commit to doing at least one thing, like one action step on behalf of their own longevity planning after listening to us today, do you have a suggestion for what that one step should be?
Yeah, I would say if you have not already, make a plan. And if you've made a plan, make sure you're working with a financial advisor, someone who can help you talk through the various issues around where you want to go and also the risks that you may want to take on and the risks that you may not want to take on.
That's very powerful. You're exactly right. Planning and preparation are key. And that's what we want to empower people to do, to really take control of planning for their future. So Alex, thank you so much for joining me today. You and I talk about these issues all the time, and it has been great to be able to share some of your wisdom with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Since longevity planning has a number of different dimensions, we're going to return to it in a future episode to talk about healthcare needs and healthcare costs as our bodies age. So please be on the lookout for that episode. And I want to thank you for joining me today. If you liked this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast and tell friends and family about it. If you have a question for me or a suggestion for this podcast, email me at dothat@truist.com. I'll be back soon for another episode of I've Been Meaning to Do That, the podcast that gets you moving toward fulfilling your purpose and achieving your financial goals. Talk to you soon.
Alex Knoll is registered representative, Truist Investment Services Incorporated, and investment advisor representative, Truist Advisory Services Incorporated. This material is presented for general information only and is not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Keep in mind that investing involves risk. The value of an investment will fluctuate over time, and you may gain or lose money. Asset allocation does not ensure a profit or guarantee against loss. Any comments or references to taxes herein are informational only. Truist and its representatives do not provide tax or legal advice. You should consult your individual tax or legal professional before taking any action that may have tax or legal consequences. An annuity is an insurance product designed for long-term savings. There are considerations to keep in mind, such as a surrender charge period on full surrenders and on certain withdrawals. Account value will be impacted by withdrawals. These vary by contract, so you want to ensure you are aware of these elements before you purchase an annuity. Withdrawals may be subject to federal and/or state income taxes. An additional 10% federal tax may apply if individuals make withdrawals or surrender their annuity before age 59 and a half. Structured investments are not suitable for all investors. Investors should carefully review product and risk considerations in investor offering documents, which should be read carefully prior to investing. Structured investments are intended to be buy and hold investments and are not liquid investments. Investment value prior to maturity will be influenced by many factors, including interest rates, the level of the reference asset, implied volatility, and the time remaining to maturity. Investors may lose some or all of their investment in connection with some of these instruments. Investing in the bond market is subject to certain risks, including market, interest rate, issuer, and inflation risk. Investments may be worth more or less than the original cost when redeemed. The S&P 500 is an unmanaged index comprised of 500 widely held securities considered to be representative of the stock market in general. An investment cannot be directly made into an index.